This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, we're live today, which means you can call and talk to me and my guest at 866-472-5788, 866-472-5788. I know if you are a longtime listener of the show, you've probably learned some things about me as I've revealed them, you know, slowly and organically throughout the show. But one thing you might not know about me is that I love poetry. And I think you might not know that about me because I haven't had that many poets on the show and we haven't talked about poetry that much. So that has to change. And it's going to change starting today with my guest. Let me tell you about her. Rika Aoki is the author of Seasonal Velocities, Hey Mele Ahilo, she'll correct me if that was wrong, and Why Dust Shall Never Settle Upon This Soul. Rika was honored by the California State Senate for extraordinary commitment to the visibility and well-being of transgender people. She worked with the American Association of Hiroshima Nagasaki A-bomb Survivors, and two of her compositions were adopted as the organization's official songs of peace. Rika is a two-time Lambda Literary Award finalist, winner of the Eli Coppola Chapbook Contest, and the Corson Bishop Poetry Prize. She has an MFA in creative writing from Cornell University and is the recipient of a university award from the Academy of American Poets. Rika is also a former national judo champion and the founder of the International Transgender Martial Arts Alliance. She is professor of English at Santa Monica College. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Rika.
Gosh, thank you so much for having me, Tristan.
So, like I said, I love poetry, and yet, for some reason, I haven't had any poets on the show, or I've had like one or two, which is weird, in 5 years.
That's probably because we've all been holed up in our rooms writing by candlelight, feeling forlorn.
Right, in that super romantic way that you do.
Absolutely.
So your first book of poetry, Seasonal Velocities, I remember that I got lunch one day. And I had my laptop with me and I was like, I'm just going to sit down to a nice lunch and read this book of poetry, knowing nothing about you. This is like my first introduction to you. And wow.
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
It hit me like a ton of bricks. Like it was not, it was unexpected and it was like visceral and it was real and it was bold and it was like in your face, unapologetic, honest, raw, wow.
Gosh, thank you. You know, with Seasonal, it really was this feeling of, well, I've pretty much ruined my life being trans and any chance of being, you know, having that sort of traditional success. So it's either backwards or forwards. And so with this book, I really tried, especially with Seasonal, my first book, that feeling of need, that feeling of like, I have to get this out because if I don't, I'm going to fall backwards was really part of the driving force for it. So I knew when I was coming out of this book that it would test the readers. And considering I hadn't published anything before, I kind of think of Seasonal Velocities as my giant stage dive where I said, well, either I'm going to screw up royally or this will be okay, but I'm going to do it as myself.
And what were some of the reactions to it when it came out?
The reactions were, at the time, Seasonal Velocities, this was even before a lot of the writers in translit have, you know, had actually published. It's a somewhat old, you know, the history of trans literature is actually, it doesn't go back that far. Mm-hmm. So at the time, it had really been, it was received with a bit of scratching of the head. I like it. I don't know where to put it. It was this sort of a reaction. The narrative that I was talking about had less to do with coming out or transitioning or my dark secret or mom's a dad, you know, that sort of thing. And it was really kind of talking about the day-to-day life of a trans person who happened to be Japanese, Japanese American. I also didn't want to blur or artificial, take that back. I didn't want to artificially separate myself. So, you know, I'm Asian. I'm as Asian as I am trans. I'm as trans as I am a woman. I'm as much of a woman as I am confused. So I wanted to put that all together and just say, okay, readers, I'm just going to give this to you. And whatever you do with it, at least it's from me. And so, yeah.
Well, one of the things that strikes me in this book is your ability to hold two seemingly disparate ideas at the same time. One of the pieces I really like is called Being Home, and which I know is originally a performance that you gave. And it sort of moves back and forth between these ideas about enlightenment and sort of self-growth and then, you know, intimate partner abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a rough one. And for that one, I did have to, it was so cathartic to perform that piece. And it was actually just as cathartic to lay it out on the page. When you work with a performance piece, you can't simply just take the script and throw it onto the page. It has to sort of be, the lines have to be broken to match what one says. But in this situation, I think what really helped me a lot was my MFA, writing, reading, and I used literary structure, I used punctuation, I used grammar as an anchor to sort of hold me to the page instead of just running away and becoming emotional and becoming inarticulate. I actually was kind of grateful that I was able to adhere to some sort of form. And I use that as an anchor to give me strength going forward, especially with a piece like that where it was very raw. I mean, that stuff happened. So, and you know, I had to live through that. And well, when I write, you know how method actors have to live through their character. I sometimes feel like I'm a method writer, where when I'm writing something and when I'm rereading it, I'm actually reliving the experience. Not always the most pleasant thing.
Well, and that sounds scary to me, because you also, there's violence in this book and there's abuse. And so did you have to you had to actually revisit those places, those times?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Had to revisit them. Revisit them often, to the point that I could write about it and not relive it in front of you. The whole trick is to have enough left in the tank that I can turn it into art, that I can make you feel the pain instead of watching me feel the pain. So in a way, it's my first book, but I'm very, very proud of it. Even though I think I've gone past it, when I look at this book, I think, my gosh, really? Was I that strong? Oh, I must not have really... I must have been okay.
Well, there's also throughout the book a lot of tension and tentativeness about your family, coming out to them, them really knowing you. I'm wondering, when you read that back, are you in a different place with your relationship with your family now?
Well, can I make this a little bit, can I go back a couple steps on this, Tristan?
Go back a couple steps.
Okay, so a lot of times we think about coming out, especially in gay or trans ways, as a very sort of set narrative. You know, with Thanksgiving coming up, I just know how many Thanksgiving dinners are going to be surprised or not surprised by, you know, mom, dad, I'm gay or I'm trans. Mm-hmm. But it's also a very Eurocentric way to come out. Part of this was realizing that, you know, family means something a little bit different to somebody who's Asian. Like, for example, if I were to come out as white American, I would come out as white American and I would still speak the same language. I could find the Cracker Barrel that nobody goes to and things like that. You know, I'd still have my culture. I could listen to my music or whatever. A lot of times with immigrant populations who come from, you know, our family is not only our tie to our blood, but also the tie to our heritage. My mother has recipes that I'm never going to be able to find. My father can tell me about times in Hawaii that will be lost if I'm not there. So the hold they have on us is a little bit different. And so we come out in a slightly different way. A lot more in Japanese community goes unsaid. I've really never had, quote unquote, the talk with my parents. But, you know, here's to say, last night, you know, or not last night, last week I was at my parents and, you know, my mother said, would you ever wear black lipstick? You know, she's wearing black lipstick on TV. And I'm looking at, well, I'd probably have a better outfit than that. And so, you know, it's these things that are, it's kind of like mom, it's kind of like these things that go unsaid where, you know, we'll be cooking and we'll be talking about the guys in the family and she'll say something like, well, I guess men are just that way, aren't they? And I'll say, yeah, I guess so. And we'll just continue, you know, wrapping dumplings. And it's that sort of gentle coming out without tipping the family over that I've been trying to negotiate. I don't have much help doing this because in the trans community, there's not many Asians who I can look at as my seniors, but mm-hmm. I think I'm doing okay on the day to day. So you know, here we go, and tomorrow will be something new, and I hope it brings me closer to my family and it brings me closer to me.
Okay, that's a good place to stop for our first commercial break. We're going to take a break, hear from my fabulous sponsor, The Pleasure Chest, who supports this program, so you should support them.
Pleasure Chest, yay! Go, go!
Yay! So let's take a break, and we will have more with Rika when we return. Hey, everyone. I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their educators' picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to tristan@puckerup.com. That's tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone.
Yay.
I'm talking today with writer and professor Rika Alki, and we were talking about her book, Seasonal Velocities, before the break. And I was struck that you said this thing about not having a ton of role models. Like, you know, it's not like you can turn on the TV and see, you know, eight different representations of Japanese American trans women. Right.
Yes. I mean, Japanese American trans women, Asian trans women. I mean, there was, I was in this documentary called Diagnosing Difference. It was a few years ago. And one of my really good friends, Cecilia Chung, was also in it. And I think one of the most interesting things is this was a situation where you could hear two Asian American trans women speak and, you know, not be the token. And you could see how different we were. And it was just really beautiful.
Yeah, because, you know, I think there's a lot of emphasis right now on the sort of transgender tipping point and transgender celebrities. But I think one of the things about your poems that strike me are that they're so grounded in a kind of real life and in some cases survival, rather than, you know, this notion that now, like, everyone knows someone trans and life is wonderful for all trans people.
I think that, well, I think some of that comes from my background. I guess, just sorry if it, you know, just with the listeners, if this shocks, but being a survivor of child abuse, when you're after my father would be beating me and I was sitting there kind of torn, to feel my sheets, to feel the wall was cool, to smell, to listen outside for birds. These things actually grounded me. And I think what they ended up doing was they helped me to develop an appreciation for finding strength in what's in front of me. So I've turned into a bit of an empiricist, Tristan. I keep my big ideas really simple. I mean, it's like, be cool to each other, don't hurt anybody, you know, have really amazing orgasms. But the but when it comes to the to how one gets there or the sloganeering, I'm far, far more, you know, about helping people now, helping myself now, trying to save an extra $2, you know, getting a hamburger so I'll have an extra couple bucks later for a cup of coffee, things like that. And my work, I think, naturally sort of keys into that. Details, the little things, I don't know where I'd be without, well, I know where I'd be without them, I'd be dead.
Well, and this reminds me of one of the pieces, there's a piece, I don't remember if it's in the first book or the second book, about a woman who imagines she's turning into a dog. And all of her senses get super heightened. As we know, dogs can smell and taste and see things like on a different level than human beings. And so it seemed like it was a departure in that there was sort of this sort of magical realism in it. And then I thought, oh my God, but this makes perfect sense because you are someone who writes a lot about the senses and the sensual, and then the idea that that would be sort of kicked up, you know, doubled or tripled. I love that piece because of that.
Oh, I'm so glad. That was one of those pieces where I really did that stage dive I was talking about. I mean, there's, like, you know, dogs fucking in that piece.
Yeah, there are.
and you know, I really classify it as one of the most erotic stories that I ever wrote because it's this idea of release. It's this idea of escape. You know, if being a human caused me all this trouble, then when I can sort of let go of all of that, that would be amazing. And, you know, when I was younger, part of transitioning was thinking about losing one's humanity. And it was very, and it still remains to this day, one of those very seductive futures, you know, where it's like, I wish I could give all of this up. Maybe that's part of why, you know, I still remain a Buddhist, you know, come back as a dog and have lots of sex. I don't know.
If we're only all so lucky.
I know. I will try to be good and go to temple and we'll see what happens.
Okay, so let's talk about sex. I've got a lot of questions. My first one is that you're queer identified.
Uh-huh.
And you have this essay in the first book about working on the organization of Dyke Day in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a quote from you. You write, "Sex is a mode of communication and acculturation that cannot be separated from social activism, political change, or anything else that queer women are trying to accomplish." And so you make the case for the fact that you know, when this stereotype that when dykes enter a room, they are exes with everyone, or they're the ex of the ex of everyone. Mm-hmm. And we've all either slept together or slept with the person that they've slept with, that actually leads to exclusion of trans women, because there are these double standards around cis dykes dating trans dykes.
Absolutely. And it's not, I think, it's one of those classic cases of institutional prejudice, institutional bias. I think that, you know, I think many dykes would say, well, I didn't mean it to be that way. And of course, I think absolutely. But the end result really is, you know, in Japan, they have the saying, you don't know somebody until you've seen them naked. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea that I know you, and, you know, I might not trust you in some areas, but I trust where I cannot trust you. And trans women in a situation like this are kind of a great unknown. I've been with, enough dykes who say, I've got this thing between my legs, and I've got no problem with that. I've sucked cocks before. And I'm thinking, yeah, but have you been with one that's been on hormones for years? And it's a different animal now. It's not like sucking a dude's cock. I'm sorry, it's changed. And I just don't think there's so much experience with being with trans women for whatever reason. I'm not going to go into that with this question, but because we don't have that familiarity, because dyke space and queer space and women's space is under attack right now, people will circle the wagons and be with the people they trust the most. And it's not that we're not worthy of trust, it's not any of that, but we still do represent a bit of an unknown. There's still a lot of people saying things about us without having experience about us. There's still even the whole concept of us as if we could be monolithic. So we got a lot of work to do.
And how do we break through that?
Date more trans women, I suppose. I mean, I could sure use a date, but, and I'm almost kind of laughing about this, but in a way, I really do believe that, if you're not going to fuck a trans woman, even if she were somebody that otherwise, you know, if trans is a deal breaker, then you're really kind of not, you're really kind of not holding us in exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not saying, screw somebody, fuck somebody just because they're trans. I'm not saying date somebody just because they're trans. But what I'm saying is, if that person really does it for you and you're looking at yourself and you're seeing trans as a deal breaker, then maybe you should ask yourself why.
It's a really good point and a really interesting point. Like if you like someone whose gender is similar to yours or whose gender is different than yours, what is it about their trans status that then changes that?
Pretty much so. And I think it's a conversation that is really hard to broach, both because, trans people, can be, I know that I can be occasionally very defensive. I can be, as open as I am now, there are sometimes I just don't want to talk about this. So I know that, sometimes I don't do my part to speak. And I also know that there are some times where cisgender dykes really should open their mind a little bit. I think we have a lot of work to do here. What makes me kind of sad is with this new presidency, and even just before that, the political climate, I'm not sure where we're going to find the time to do this or the space to do this. Mm. But maybe we can work together. I mean, the idea that we can't come to some sort of understanding, I think we're too smart for that. I think we can.
Well, speaking of the administration, tell me for you on a personal level, like what it means to be living as a trans woman of color, a queer trans woman of color under a Trump presidency.
The real answer, Tristan?
Yeah, the real. We're only real here.
Okay. The real answer is it's always been this bad for us. And now straight people, white people, cis people are finally learning what it's like to be treated like a trans woman of color. We've already been here. Frankly, I see very, very little change. from my perspective. I work with trans youth. I've seen what's happened. I know my story. I know the looks people give us. I know they don't like us. I know they'd rather want, many of them want us dead. And it's just, that's what it has meant to be an American in or living in the United States. It's just been this way. I think what Trump has done is, and the Trump, you know, the idea that so many of my cis white friends are going, I can't believe that so many people supported Trump. It's really no surprise to me. I wish that I had been wrong, Tristan. I wish that you could have said, ha ha, look, that we would never do that. And I wish that we could have had something better. But when I look at these things, all my feeling is, it took you this long to figure out how bad things were. Not you personally, but just, you know, some of my friends on Facebook. Of course, they've always been this way. And so this is one of those things where it's kind of sometimes a barrier to us actually forming a coalition. To a lot of people, this has been a change. But for most of us of color who have lived kind of under these multiple sort of theaters of oppression, this is actually the status quo. It has been this way.
Yeah, so it's a big wake-up call to people who are not in positions of power and privilege.
Right. And the idea on one hand is to speak with some of my other friends who are also women of color, trans women of color, to show compassion towards the people who are just waking up and say, look, better waking up now than never. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because they're all saying, you know, what the fuck is going on? You know, that just shows their privilege. And I go, yes, it does show their privilege, but they're still being attacked. And also, you know, to the people who have just woken up, it's like, look, I get it. You guys look around and this stuff is bad. But before you think that you're going to take your same place leading the movement, wouldn't it be nice for you to shut up and listen to the people who have already been here, who've got the experience, know the enemy, know what's happening, and, you know, have developed strategies? Don't reinvent the wheel. You should listen to us. We have survived with no privilege for years. Maybe we've got some skills that you should think about before you go saying what we should or shouldn't do, and, you know, who the leader of our community is.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another commercial break. When we come back, I'm going to get you to read the introduction, the foreword to your newest book, Why Dust Shall Never Settle Upon This Soul. So everyone, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Hey everyone, I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their educators picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com. You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com.
Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Yay. We're talking today with Rika Aoki. And I am first going to tell you what's going on at the Pleasure Chest. As you know, they have these classes. They're from 8 to 10 p.m. They're all free. They're part of their Pleasure Ed program. And I want to tell you the ones that are coming up soon. In L.A., November 8th, Thrilling Threesomes with Chris and Michelle. In New York City, November 4th, How the Heck Do I Date at This Age with one of my favorite presenters, Joan Price. That one's not free. That one actually has an admission charge. November 7th, Verbal Domination Skills with Simone Justice. November 8th, Some Like It Rough with Ryan. Those are all in New York City. So go to pleasurechest.com to find out about these events and more. So your latest book is called Why Dust Shall Never Settle Upon This Soul. And the foreword, I think the foreword just has a lot of great information in it. And so I want, and also it raised questions for me. And I felt like, oh, I have to let the audience in on this foreword before I ask you all these questions.
Wow. Okay. Well,
so
I'm glad someone read the foreword. So I'm really, yes.
Okay. So you're going to take it away.
Onward. Okay. So here we go. I debated whether or not to add a foreword to this book. Part of me wants very much to let the poems speak for themselves. But this book represents the end of a long journey for me. It's my first book ever dedicated to poetry, something that I was not sure was going to happen. In fact, up until only a few years ago, I thought it would be impossible. I feel so many emotions right now. It's a lot to process, and I've always processed best on paper, and I feel like I'd like some company along the way. Poetry is where I've always felt most at home. However, being home has always been complicated. Although I love the idea of being home, home itself was never a safe or viable place. I looked to poetry as an escape from my actual home. And when somehow I was admitted to the MFA program at Cornell University, I discovered an environment so rarefied and magical that I thought I might finally get away. Cornell was like nothing I had ever seen, at least in reality. I was stunned by how the faculty lived and work. And with all my heart, I wished for a future life like theirs with a quiet office, a well-worn desk, a wall of books, a comfy chair and a window overlooking some sort of courtyard or garden. I had no desire to deal with ugliness, with violence, my past. I wanted a locked door with frosted glass. I couldn't even think about justice. I just wanted to leave my childhood home for a newer, quieter, safer one. I wanted an escape. I wanted peace. Yet being at Cornell was far from peaceful. Most of my time I was frustrated, not at my classmates, nor even the interminably cold winters, but at my own inability to become the writer I felt I had to be, cultured, privileged, and above all, brilliantly safe. Yet the more I tried to be that ideal artist, the more I felt like I was missing something vital. Ownership, self. I felt surrounded by people who knew who they were, their stations, what they wanted to write. Me, pale imitations all. Now, more than any other type of writing, I feel that poetry demands truth. There's nothing Hollywood glamorous about writing a poem. It's clumsy stumbling most of the time, with generous helpings of self-importance and self-pity. But at least for me, the poem must contain truth. If I'm being evasive or lying, even unconsciously, the poem reacts. There's nothing like a poem to remind you where and who you are, even if you don't know yourself. I returned from Ithaca even more lost and confused. I was back where I started with my one ticket out of town wasted. There'd be no comfy office, no courtyard, no peace. It was over. I most likely would have broken, had not one lucky act saved me. I continued to write poetry. And somehow, my constant probing for what was wrong with my poetry led me to find out what was wrong with me, which finally led me to realize that writing wasn't the only issue I had. You see, it wasn't until leaving Cornell that I realized all those years of not fitting, of feeling I had the wrong voice, might have been in part because I was transgender. And soon after, my therapist helped me admit to myself that I had been the victim of child abuse. The process was so painful, but yeah, it was really painful. But it was emancipating and strengthening. With new eyes, I looked back at the poems that truly inspired me. Not the names and lifestyles, but the actual words. I realized that my favorite poems did not run away from their pasts. They transformed them. After trying to write poetry from a perspective and privilege I never had, I finally stopped trying to be somewhere and someone else. I began to concentrate not on running or escaping my world, but in facing and transforming it. My time at Cornell, and even before that, my time home, began to fall into context, producing newfound form and richness. And gradually, a type of poetry finally began to come from a hand, heart, and voice I could truly call my own. In the past, I desired a poetry that offered escape from the pain and the nonsensical cruelty of the world. Forget this life. Somewhere in the chaos of the world, there had to be a room for a pastoral quiet space where none of the outside world mattered. You can spend lifetimes waiting for a place like that. Yet, are we really interested in poems and poetry that come from such a quiet bucolic fiction? While at Cornell, one of my professors once said that in the U.S., we kill our poets with kindness. At the time, I thought he was crazy. But after my experiences, I realized his wisdom. Why do poets seem to rise from places and spaces of oppression? Why do those who hunger for existence, significance, and safety also seem to hunger for verse? In my hangings out with other queers of color, I become familiar with a pattern, one that resonates with my own life, where oppression is more than having nameable obstacles and villains. Life itself becomes the enemy. Whether it's planning your trip around a non-existent gender-neutral bathroom or taking 4 hours to run a 20-minute errand because the bus is late, life itself is oppressive when the only thing that seems to have any regularity are the bills or the insults or the panic attacks that keep you awake at night. Oppression is the extra pain you feel in your bladder, the sodden feeling you get when someone accuses you of going to McDonald's when it's the only way you can take your kids out for a meal in a place with air conditioning. Oppression reduces conflict and meaning to an impersonality that can pummel a soul until even existence loses meaning. For when society institutions and institutions operate on a statistical scale, where on earth is there room for the personal? What gives the self its significance? At times such as this, it's not only the body that most thirsts or hungers, but the soul. We can do far more if we simply know that we matter, that there is significance in who we are and in what we do. And this is where I finally realized that poetry can sing. Unlike the weightiness of essays or prose, poems can be portable, personal things. Poetry links us, not through our shared philosophies or stories, but through the minutiae of our day-to-day existences. A poem can bring seemingly endless, stupid, impersonal craziness to a personal human scale, and at least for a while, provide space for contemplation, reflection, or even a little space. In Ars Poetica, Archibald MacLeish writes, "For all the history of grief, an empty doorway in a maple leaf. One doorway, not a labyrinth of closed doors. One leaf, not a forest of lost opportunities." Poetry is one of the few ways we can transform the broad brand of oppression into something manageable. It does this by insisting one's personal experiences, one's personal world, does not merely exist in the world, but embodies it. We don't have to measure ourselves against the global or universal. Our existences themselves are enough to connect and sanctify us. Poems remind us that we are significant, not because of how much land we own or how many guns we have, but who we intrinsically are. This is a world where some children laugh and others are beaten, where some children are cast out, others blend right in, where some have clean water and bed sheets, where we force our activists into ignoring their health, our artists to give up before they turn 25, where people are so addled, so shell-shocked and overwhelmed that they protest their own health insurance, where there are picnics and beaches and fireflies and even ice cream, This is a world where poetry most matters, not through its ability to offer escape, but in its ability to transform one's surroundings and link even God and eternity to one's coffee mug search for a shopping list, significance, and truth. But here, perhaps, I'll stop and let the poems take over. Thank you so much for listening, for reading, and for being alive. Hug, Rika.
Oh, I just love that.
Oh.
Okay, I just love that. I mean, there's just so much in there. It's so intense. Okay, let's break down a few of the things here.
Okay.
I love this idea that you wanted a locked door with frosted glass.
Yes.
A sense of it calls to mind all these things, a sense of safety, of a very clear boundary, but also class. Like it calls to mind this sort of particular kind of office, right? In a nice building that's like old and has history to it. So there's also these class dynamics with like sort of imagining a different you, right? This is like the dog thing, right? Imagining a different you, which I think just runs throughout your work and is so powerful, because I think we all, no matter our gender identity or other social identity markers, like to imagine different selves, right? What else might be sort of out there? But I also really feel like you articulate poetry as a kind of survival strategy.
Absolutely.
In that it's like it doesn't take up a lot of space or words. And again, it can be accessible to like a lot of different kinds of people.
Yes. And I think the portability is the entire thing. It's very subversive how poetry packs so much nutrition in such a small space. It's also something that can be duplicated and can be viral. Poetry is one of the first types of art that, you know, we talk about music, the music people or the movie people worried about copyright. Well, that's something that poets have had to deal with since the beginning of time. Our work is copyable. If you know, your copy of Why Dust Shall Never Settle, you can Xerox it and give it to somebody, and they've got a copy just as good as my manuscript. So it is by nature a public art. It's something that that societies need, molds where it goes, who writes it, who says it, who holds it dear, in a way that I think is kind of unique. You don't need to play a violin to read poetry. You just need to be able to read it. You don't need any special computer. You can just, you know, it's there. It's amazing.
Yeah, and so it seems like it could be a tool in this moment when we're trying to build bridges across difference in a meaningful and impactful way. That's how it spoke to me. Your forward is like poetry as tool for resistance.
Poetry as tool for resistance, but it has to remain poetry. A lot of times people who write poetry will get to where we need to go in a very roundabout way, or it seems roundabout until the poetry is complete. There needs to be, I would like to have readers who, you know, my best readers are the readers who are trustworthy, who understand that I might go from point A to point Z back to point C, but it's actually the shortest way to get there. A lot of people would like to see poetry that is more easily domesticated, that can be set to a march, that can say the party line. But saying the party line and writing poetry are two completely different things. And this is a situation where members of our community have to trust that other members of the community are doing things that they may not understand, but hey, we're all marching in the same direction. We're all people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take another break. We are going to come back for our final segment. Don't go anywhere. Still have lots of questions. So stay with us. More with Rika after the break.
Yay!
Hey, everyone. I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their Educators Picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey. I've been talking today with writer and poet Rika. I'm going to say it better this time. Aoki? Like it's Yay. Like there's Aoki.
Aoki. Joseph. Okay. These are really good.
Okay. Before I just keep going like down this rabbit hole, I want to give you a chance to plug that you have a new class at Lit Reactor. So before we keep going down the rabbit hole of poetry, tell me about this class at Lit Reactor.
Well, what's going on right now is I've been teaching a lot of composition, and I'm trying to branch out to teach creative writing and some of the things that I've done. So at Lit Reactor in February, I'm really excited. There's going to be this, I'm going to be teaching travel writing, and it's called A Mile in Whose Shoes, writing vividly and consciously about your road trips, journeys, and detours that come your way. I'm really looking forward to this because this is, you know, we talk about like the queer, we talk about like the travel, sort of like the travel trope, and it's usually some white guy in a hat, you know, going places and killing the natives or, you know, discovering themselves or something. And there's so much more to travel writing. We do so much more, you know, just by meeting people, discovering, you know, being trans is a type of travel. But how do we move from community to community without being an oppressor? How do we do it sensitively? How do we do it in a way that's mutually satisfying and mutually beneficial? So this is what I'm going to be attempting to teach in February. Right now, the page isn't up. In fact, this class just got okayed last week, so none of the preparations are there. It starts February 6th. The best way to get to it is to get to my website, rikarika.com, R-Y-K-A-R-Y-K-A.com, and I'll keep people updated. When we teach these writing classes, we really do rely on the community. So if you like what I'm saying and you want to learn a little bit of more of my story or learn a little bit more about your story, please drop by and check me out.
Oh, I love that idea because a lot of people love to write about their travels and think, oh my God, that would be the best job in the world, right? You know, to go amazing places and write about it. But to write about it mindfully, especially as Americans, I feel like is a tall order.
I think it's a tall order, but I think that discovering that and discovering how one does it, Americans, it's this paradox where we're such a monoculture here, as diverse as we are, we're a monoculture, we're a monolingual monoculture, and we should be traveling, but when we're traveling, we should be mindful of what we're doing. And I actually think that when we get out of our American shell, we have a far more enjoyable and a far more meaningful time. If we show a little bit of vulnerability, I think the payoff is tremendous, which is kind of why I want to teach this class.
Yeah, I love that idea. Okay, so the other thing that really struck me in reading your latest book of poetry is there is a kind of loneliness and longing in your poems that comes through almost all the time. And I wondered if you would talk about that.
Well, at least my experience of being trans is being trans is a bit, it's always been a bit of a social barrier. But I'm not going to ascribe that all to being trans. Being the victim of child abuse causes one to feel different. Why can't I be like the other kids? Being trans, why can't I be like, you know, the other women? And there's this feeling eventually of kind of being forlorn. And unfortunately, life hasn't given me any lessons to the counter. I've had relationships break up, and the last parting thing somebody has said has been transphobic. I've watched some really amazing trans women just crying on my shoulder because, you know, lots of people would love to have sex with them. They pay for it. But for somebody to take them home and say, this is my partner who I'm going to stand with, we're going to build a life together, that's a little bit more difficult. Now, I'm not saying that they're not out there, but it's kind of a giant point of contention. And so a lot of what I'm trying to find out when I'm writing these works is, even when I'm writing about a relationship, there's this, it's all kind of like faction, where it's not simply where I am in a relationship, but what I wish that relationship would be. Sometimes I think about my poetry as almost being messages in a bottle, where it's like, love me, love me, love me. I'm really more than being trans. I'm really more than just being all of these things that you see as deal breakers. You know, I can be a good lay. I can put your head on my shoulder. I can put my head on your shoulder. You know, I cook a really mean baked chicken, and you know, there's got to be a place in this world for me, and that comes through in a lot of my work. And, you know, and it's something one deals with, it's something I deal with every day. Now I realize that this is very much a first world problem. You know, I have a roof over my head. I'm a professor. You know, I'm talking to you. People know me. But sometimes the soul yearns for something a little bit more intimate.
And it just seems like from out of the gate, you have gone to these really tender places in your work. You know, places that other people, like, don't want to go.
That's because I love people. I mean, in all seriousness, I don't believe that. I also think about the writer. I mean, I also think about the little trans girl or the trans woman or the trans person, or maybe somebody who's not even trans but sees it as an analog, who might pick my book up. And I'm just thinking, I love you so much. I want you to know that I love you. And so when I'm writing this stuff, it's like, I might have this one poem to get through to you. I'm not going to waste those lines on being fake. Now, I never know which one I'll hit. And I want it all to be, no matter where you pick my pieces up, that you know I care. And we're going to have this moment together. And it might be the only line you ever read that you'll read, but I want you to know that I love you.
Are you working on a new book?
Yes. Right now I'm working, I'm trying to get this manuscript done. I've been doing it for 2 years. But this latest book is about, I'm really happy. This is another novel coming out, and it's about, a woman who's, you know, a woman who teaches violin lessons, and she's cursed, and she's got to exchange souls to win her soul back, and who comes into her life, but a trans runaway, and navigating, and as she tries to teach this trans runaway, she finds that she's beginning to protect her as a mother protects a child. They develop a maternal bond. And so she becomes conflicted as to, you know, whether she's going to protect this soul or save herself. And it's set in the San Gabriel Valley, which is an incredibly Asian
Latino. I live in the San Gabriel Valley.
Yes. So it's going to be in El Monte, in Alhambra, in San Gabriel, in Rosemead, in Pasadena.
Cool. Yep,
and I really want to show a little bit about the Los Angeles that people don't know about, the Los Angeles area, you know, that it's more than La La Land. There are so many magical stories that happen here, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm new here, you know, like I've only been here 2 years, but it's nothing like you imagine it's going to be, especially on this side of town.
We should all go have a totally different world. Yes, it's a totally different world.
Yeah.
And it's a world that doesn't have to be, you know, and it's a world with so much magic, a world with so many stories, and it's a world that doesn't have to be unknown. So with this piece, you know, since this is kind of a lot of where I grew up, I really wanted to take the San Gabriel Valley and the people I grew up with and write about them, not as writing fiction from people of color, but in the same way everybody gets to write about their own neighborhood and the people they hold dear.
Mm, yeah. Okay. Well, I can't wait for that one.
Thank you.
We are out of time. I want to remind all of you that you should be supporting independent writers and artists. And Rika's book of poetry, her latest one, is called Why Dust Shall Never Settle Upon This Soul.
I hope you like it.
Her website is rikarika.com. She's on Twitter at Rika_Aoki, A-O-K-I. And on Facebook, Books by Rika Aoki. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my engineer, and everyone at Voice America. Hey, next Friday, you know what? I'm going to be in Cancun, Mexico. That's right. I'm going to be at the Swing Set takeover of Desire, and I can't wait. I'm getting on a plane tomorrow, and I'm so excited. And of course, I'm going to tell you all about it, and I'm going to record some shows there while I'm there. So you'll get to hear all about Mexico for days and days and days. But that means that Raymond Johnson, who has been with me from the beginning and is my associate producer, is filling in as my guest host next week. So he's so funny. I really encourage you to tune in because I will be tuning in even though I'll be in Mexico. So until then, you can find me on facebook.com/asktristan, on Twitter. The show is at Sex Out Loud Radio. I am on Twitter and on Instagram at Tristan Taramino. And in the meantime, go read some poetry this weekend while I'm having a cocktail by the pool. Okay? Later.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.